space. Images begin to appear. Images of strange and powerful forces. But of all the forces in the universe, the two most powerful, Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior, prepare to explode. Champion versus champion. Title for title. It's the ultimate challenge. It's WrestleMania!
Ready to go inside the ropes like you've never been before and watch the most famous and infamous matches in wrestling history along with legends of the squared circle. Welcome to the first wrestling podcast in the world to take you on a weekly deep dive into classic matches. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Payoff. It's the ultimate challenge. Welcome to an all-new episode of The Payoff. This is Tom Healy, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Jeffrey Ryan. Jeff, do you hear the excitement in my voice? This is one of my all-time favorite matches. And not only that, we also have a huge announcement to make here shortly. But first, how the hell are you doing?
And I am feeling the power of positivity, and it's a great day, a new day, my friend. We've got a classic match, and all I can hear in my head is Gorilla Monsoon saying, the irresistible force meeting the immovable object. So we've been doing this for a month now, and we cannot say thank you enough to our loyal listeners. We're still overwhelmed with the positive response. You know, shout out to the people of the Apple store I spent a few hours in today. It was more Verizon's fault than Apple's fault. But, you know, the guy ended up, found out that he was a big wrestling fan along with some people in the store, shared the payoff with the store's group chat. And so thank you not only to the Apple geniuses for helping me out, but just like we want you all out there to do, we want them and you to subscribe, give us 5 stars, spread the word about the payoff. It's the only way we're going to continue to be successful. So you can always find the payoff on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Payoff Pod. Tom and myself are both out there too. It's at Payoff Tom, at Payoff Jeff. And so Tom, I know you first off have some info to share about our newly released Patreon page.
Yeah, well, some great networking in the Apple store today. Very, very impressed with that. And hey, just another thing that I want to acknowledge. Jeff, did you know that 15% of our audience is from the United Kingdom? How cool is that?
I did not know that, Tom. Thank you for sharing that.
First of many fun facts we're going to cover here today on The Payoff. So as Jeff mentioned, we are now live on Patreon. You can find that at payoffpatreon.com. That's payoffpatreon.com. We have one tier and it's loaded with a bunch of stuff. It's all listed there. But just to quickly give a rundown, we've got the weekly after show. That's an ad-free, you'll never guess it, after show. We can keep talking about the match that we're covering of the week. We also have a monthly bonus match. That's an ad-free bonus episode of another match where we'll watch it with a legend and discuss it. And the third thing is we have a poll every week where you pick the bonus match, not us. We'll put a list up there and you pick what match you want us to do. Another thing is weekly transcripts. We give you a full transcript of the episode. There's also a chat going on where we'll post stuff and engage and just talk about whatever you guys want to talk about. And finally, we give an on-air thank you to each new patron on the after show. So whole bunch of stuff, some bonus stuff, bunch of ad-free stuff, polls, engagement. We're also going to post some bonus stuff about the current product on there, just as we we want to. So whole bunch of stuff, one tier, it's $10 for all of that. And every dollar of that's going right back into the show to make it even better for all of our loyal listeners. So if you're interested, payoffpatreon.com, and your support is greatly, greatly appreciated, because we're going to keep making this show better and better. And speaking of better and better, Jeff, before we get started, is there a major announcement you want to make here on The Payoff?
We want to make, absolutely. So we've been hinting at it a little bit. We've been talking about it occasionally, but we can now officially announce not only will Tom and myself be representing The Payoff at StarCast as vendors all week, but we will also be performing our show live. And so we are extremely excited. It's all going to go down on Friday, August 30th at 8 p.m. We aren't going to announce our special guests until a little closer to the show, but this is something we've had on our list of goals and, you know, something that fans have been asking for and something that we wanted. And we cannot wait to bring you The Payoff live.
Whew. Absolutely, man. It's an incredible honor to be involved in StarCast 3. You know, when we first started doing this and really just kicking around the idea of doing it, you know, one of those kind of stretch goal, way big, crazy ideas we had was, hey, man, maybe eventually we'll do a stage show. You know, we were just like, could you imagine? And had a good laugh about it. But not only is it happening, but it's happening a hell of a lot quicker than we expected. And we're excited and humbled, and it's big. So a big thank you and shout out to Conrad and his entire team. We can't imagine the amount of time, effort, and patience that probably goes into pulling off a wrestling convention. And so we're honored and thrilled and, like we said, humbled to be a tiny part of what is going to be an awesome Labor Day weekend outside of Chicago. So finally, Jeff, I'll say this. We're both thankful for this opportunity, but I think we're also both 100% committed to keeping our foot on the gas. We want to grow every week. We want to get better every week and just continue busting our asses to make this show better for all of you. You guys are loyal. You're listening. You're supporting the show. And we want to make it as strong as we can. And so we're both in this for the long run. We can't wait to keep sharing awesome matches and insights and guests with you each Monday. And ultimately, your support each week is why we're able to do this and why we've been given this incredible opportunity. So thank you, thank you, thank you for helping make this happen for us. We really appreciate it. Jeff, let's quickly let everyone know how we do things here on The Payoff.
That was really nice, buddy. I was touched. So I'm sure the listeners will be too. So of course, we give you a weekly deep dive into a match every Monday. And each episode is broken down into three parts. So part one is the build, where we lay the foundation of what got us to the match, what was going on in the business, and really anything else you'll find interesting. Part two is the payoff, where we watch the match along with a legend or superstar of the business. And then part three, the aftermath, where we talk about what happened after the finish of the match, share how it was received by the wrestling community, and provide our own thoughts on the match and the story surrounding it and just kind of everything that happened. So, Tom, I know we're both excited to talk about this match, but now that we can officially celebrate being a 1 month old, you want to share with our fans what we have available in the archives and then why we picked this match too.
Yeah, so each week we cover one match. We don't talk about the current product. We work hard to bring you new insights, and we try to make it as entertaining as possible. So as Jeff said, we've been at this for over a month, so we actually have an archive of matches, and that's pretty cool. If you're new to the show, and this is the first time or one of the first times you're listening to us, make sure to check out the archives and listen to some great episodes. We've got Eddie Guerrero's first world title win, the infamous Judy Bagwell on a pole match, the Magnum Tully I Quit steel cage match, the classic Pillman Liger light heavyweight match, and finally last week's episode, which I think we both agree was awesome. That was Raven and Tommy Dreamer, Loser Leaves Town match, ECW, Wrestlepalooza 1997. We watched it along with Raven. His insights and perspective and some of the nuances that he was walking through were just fantastic. So make sure to check out the archives if you haven't caught those shows yet. They're all awesome in their own way, and we're really proud of those so far. And I think we can confidently say we've got a pretty good slate of matches coming up as well. So here we are, brand new week of The Payoff, Classic match, awesome feud, two of the most iconic characters in the history of the business. And we have a guest that you may not have heard of or certainly haven't heard much from. He has a fascinating perspective. His name is Rick Bassman. He's actually the person who discovered and helped train the Ultimate Warrior and many other legends at the beginning of their careers. Now, Rick was a fantastic guest because he was very open and honest with us, which you'll certainly hear during the payoff as we watch the match together. If you don't know much about Rick Bassman, at least look up his Wikipedia page. It's this unbelievable resume in sports and entertainment and MMA. It's crazy what he did over the course of his career, and much of it you probably had no clue about. So definitely, as you're listening to this, check out Rick Bassman's Wikipedia page and do a little digging on him. Really fascinating guy, and as you heard, or you will hear, just an awesome guest as well. So before we jump into the build to the match each week, Jeff and I like to share why we chose the particular match. Now, some matches we pick are classics, right? They're all-time classics. You've heard of them. You've seen them a million times. Some of them are infamous, right? There's just something crazy that happened. Those are fun to cover too. And then other times we're going to cover hidden gems. You may be like, why are they covering this match? And then you watch it, you're like, oh, that was really good. And I learned a lot of stuff I'd never heard before. So we try to give you a little bit of everything. We try to jam these in with like facts and things going on in the business and a whole bunch of stuff. And so this week's match, as you can probably imagine, was a pretty easy pick because it is an iconic classic match. Now, as a kid, Jeff, this was about as big as it got for me, man. You had the two biggest stars in the WWF clashing for the first time. You had champion first champion, which you never saw. You had good guy versus good guy, which you never saw. And you had a hell of a wild crowd in Toronto. So this match to me had it all, and I am really looking forward to covering it. Jeff, I know you were a huge Hogan and Warrior mark as well. What excites you about us covering this match this week?
Yeah, you know, what more needs to be said? You know, people have some strong feelings about both guys nowadays, but in 1990, there was no one higher on the mountain than Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior. I had the toys. I was eating my vitamins because Hulk told me to. I believe the Warrior got his power from the ropes. I mean, these guys just embodied the brand and lived it in every single way. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, they still do, or, you know, Hogan still does, and the Warrior lives on that way. But I'm hulking out over this one. I'm excited to talk about it. So,
now, did you have a wrestling buddy?
Yeah, oh, yeah, of course. Everybody did.
Which one?
I had Hogan.
Okay. I think I had Hogan and Warrior.
I had like a tall stand up, like plastic Hogan, too, that was like 16 inches tall, too. So, of course.
Yeah, you know, my mom's probably happy that they didn't have those like fat heads back then because I probably would have just like covered my bedroom wall with all those guys.
That would have been exciting. That would have been a good picture. So, this match is too big to waste any more time. So, let's jump right into the build.
All right. Here we are. The build. Let us set the stage for you. It's WrestleMania 6, April 1st, 1990. We're at the Sky Dome in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. We have an all-time attendance record in that building at the time of 67,678. The tagline for the event, of course, is the Ultimate Challenge. Now, just some fun facts from this evening. If you haven't seen it in a while or you don't remember it, the opening montage of Vince McMahon doing a voiceover dramatically saying the two most powerful forces in the universe are going to collide, it's awesome. His over-the-top voiceovers during this era and those montages were really, really good. Go back and watch them. It's probably one of the best intros to a pay-per-view maybe they've ever done. It's so over the top, but it's so awesome. And six-year-old Tommy was marking out hard for it. This is the first WrestleMania that took place outside the USA. There were 14 matches on this show, Jeff. Plus, they had a dark match. And you'll notice the main event didn't even start until the 3-hour and 9-minute mark. So of these 15 matches, there were only two that went over 10 minutes. It's not like now where they tried to jam a bunch of guys on the show through multi-man matches. This was just all single and tag matches. So it was just a a lot going on, and they didn't have the 8-man or 10-woman ladder match or tag match to jam people on the card or battle royals. They just did it through a lot of really, really short matches. The only match other than the main event to go over 10 minutes was Ted DiBiase, who was obviously the $1 million champion at the time, successfully defending against Jake the Snake Roberts. And of course, that match added a count out, which was one of three matches ending in a count out that night. So we had really strict refs back then, Jeff, and Jack Tunney, man, he kept those guys in line. We have a lot of missed kinds of reffing this day and age, unfortunately. Guys just don't ref like they used to. Another fun fact from this show is it was Andre the Giant's final WrestleMania match. There was a really cool moment where he turned on Bobby Heenan. It was not the best looking punch you're ever going to see in your life if you go back and look, but the crowd loved it, and it was nice to see Andre get a send-off. You know, he did appear at the following year's WrestleMania, but man, at the time, he could barely move around, and it was good to see he had kind of a fun moment. And like I said, the crowd went nuts for that. Now, there was a match on the show that really upset me, and it was Dusty Rhodes and Sapphire, who were accompanied by Miss Elizabeth, defeating Queen Sherry and Randy Savage. It's weird because, you know, when I was a kid, I just didn't understand what the big thing with Dusty was, right? He had this unremarkable WWF run. My only memory of him was the polka dot goofball with Sapphire. So Dusty wasn't being used properly. And then I thought this was just a very underwhelming spot for Randy Savage. If you remember, he stole the show at WrestleMania 3 against Ricky Steamboat. He stole the show at WrestleMania 4, just really the entire tournament with the different outfits and, you know, winning, and then obviously a great match with the championship on the line against Ted DiBiase. And then WrestleMania 5, which was the payoff to one of the best builds in company history, where it was him and Hogan, and he turned midway through the run. So it's disappointing that we didn't maybe get a great Dusty Savage match or something that was a little bit more serious. I know the crowd liked it, but Savage would go on to have a great match at WrestleMania 7 and then a great match at WrestleMania 8. So it just in this run of great WrestleMania matches just wasn't that great. Otherwise, Randy Savage had an unbelievable, and I would argue underrated, 6-year run at the Showcase of the Immortals. A couple more things on my notes here. This is actually Jesse Ventura's last stint as a color commentator at a pay-per-view. Continued the role until August of 1990 on Superstars, and then he left the company. You know, as you heard during the main event of the match we're going to watch here, dude, Jesse Ventura was so good on commentary. Overall, Jeff, it's a one-match show. There's no question about it. But that's the reason we're here this week, because it was a really, really, really good one match. So, Jeff, every week you do a great job of walking us through how we got to the match from a storyline standpoint. So how did we get the title versus title, Hogan versus Warrior?
Yeah, the first signs of a build to this match was their face-off at Royal Rumble on January 21st, 1990. Before I get too far into the build, I want to remind our listeners that there wasn't a lot of monthly pay-per-views during this time. It was the big ones as we know them. It was Rumble in January and then WrestleMania in April, then SummerSlam and Survivor Series, but they really only had about a solid 3 or so month build, and most of it played out on TV. The Royal Rumble card, it was, I say, fairly uninspiring, in my opinion, except for the actual Rumble. I cannot recommend enough, though, that along with this WrestleMania 6 match we're discussing, go back and watch this Royal Rumble. It sets up a lot, you know, it's the initial setup for this match when they face off, but, and we watch a lot of stuff around here, but this one is absolutely worth your time. So after the Rumble, which again, January 21st, on February 3rd, a week after these two met at Royal, or, you know, were in the ring at Royal Rumble, Hogan issued the Ultimate Challenge. So to me, this was classic WWF storyline at the time. It just kind of funny and gimmicky, but it was the Hulkster needed to know whether Hulkamania or the power of the Warrior was the strongest force in the WWF. And so to me, you don't need much more story than that, because at the time, that was great. That's all people needed. So an interesting side note that I want to put out there, that kind of during my research, one piece that I found said that the WWE newly debuted Earthquake actually helped push this story along. you had babyface versus babyface, like we've said, and that was not very common then. And so they needed to get a little bit of heat between these guys. And so that's where Earthquake came into play. He squashed both of them and not like jobbed out, or they were jobbed out to Hogan, you know, Hogan and Warrior were jobbed out to him. It's he literally did a splash onto them and squashed them, which was his move. And both thought, like, after, you know, they got up and there was some pushing back and forth in the ring and then shenanigans, one thing led to another. And Hogan and Warrior thought each other were kind of responsible for what happened. So they were able to keep that babyface, but it added an element of why these two guys weren't big fans of each other. So fast forward a little bit, February 10th, the match is then made official by who is at the time, KFAB WWF president Jack Tunney. And so it was really just his on-screen persona at the time, but that, you know, he made the match official. And then February 24th, a few weeks later, that he announced that both championships, the World Heavyweight Championship and the Intercontinental Championship, would be on the line for the first time ever together. So something else to remind our listeners, that long title reigns were more common really because of this pay-per-view schedule. Warrior had the Intercontinental belt since August of 89, and Hogan, the superstar he was and is, he had the championship for the entire previous year, winning it at WrestleMania 5 from Randy Savage. So belt against belt at this time was unheard of, and it was a really big deal. So nothing else I can really add. So Tom, you got any other thoughts?
There's a lot of Earthquake in that build, huh, Jeff?
You got to love a lot of Earthquake. Like, that was a great, I love that tag team. But anyways,
great job as always. It's good to know the build and really how we get to the payoff. Just a couple other things in my notes. I am a major Jack Tunney mark, and I don't know if you knew that about me, Jeff. I think he's the greatest leader in company history. And seriously, I always thought that was a great way to use it, right? It made sense that someone was making these matches. It was logical, but wasn't the overbearing authority figure, general manager, commissioner, whatever the hell else they're called, right, that we would come to know later on. So just loved the way you had Jack Tunney doing things and the way they had that character lined up. The Royal Rumble face-off, it's one of the better things probably in the history of the company. Just incredible. And if you haven't seen it in a while, or you don't remember it, or you've never seen it, go back and watch it. Plenty of clips on YouTube, or watch the build-up to it on the network. It was also wild during that moment hearing Tony Schiavone on the call. Just kind of surprised he didn't call it the biggest moment in our great sport. But really good stuff there. Some trivia for our listeners. Hogan and Warrior. It's the first face-versus-face main event in WrestleMania history. Now, WrestleMania 6 was the first April Fool's Day WrestleMania, and there's been three April Fool's Day WrestleManias since. Each one of those has ended in a face-versus-face battle. 2001, WrestleMania X7 concludes with The Rock and Steve Austin, although Austin did turn heel in the closing minutes. 6 years later, again, April 1st, WrestleMania 23, which you were at, Jeff, headlined by John Cena and Shawn Michaels, both faces. And then the most recent example, WrestleMania 28, which is the one I was at in Miami, John Cena and The Rock, their historic once-in-a-lifetime clash that happened the year after. So kind of interesting. Now, here we go. Each week, we give you the timestamp if you want to watch the match along with our special guest. If you're in the car, at work, at the gym, don't want to watch, you can always go back and watch later if you'd like. But if you want to watch the match with Rick Bassman, go to the WWE Network, find WrestleMania 6, and hit play at 3 hours and 9 minutes on the nose as soon as you hear the ding, ding, ding following our break. Again, WrestleMania 6, 3 hours and 9 minutes on the nose if you would like to watch along. So here we go. It's time for the payoff. All right, this is the payoff, and I am here with Mr. Rick Bassman. Rick, man, I've been really excited to have this conversation. You're one of those names that growing up and reading the dirt sheets and being a fan of the business, I've heard all kinds of stuff about you. So it's great to do a little research on you and now have a chance to talk to you. So welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, man. It's my pleasure being here. You've heard all kinds of stuff, huh? The good, the bad, and the ugly, I'll bet.
No, you know what? Mostly good, although I will tell you, I was Googling you a little bit today and came across one guy. We'll talk about him later. I think he's full of shit, so it's fine. So we're watching Warrior and Hogan here. First, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and just how in the heck you got involved in training professional wrestlers.
Well, I'll dive right into the wrestling side of things, and we could work into the rest as we go, if that's all right with you.
That'd be great. But,
this goes back to about 1985 when Hulkamania was running wild. I had grown up a big fan back when territories were still a thing. I grew up in California, really, really got into wrestling at that point, bought all the magazines, big fan of the After mags. Bill After's now an old pal of mine. It's funny how things come around full circle in this business. And then I ducked out of it for a while. I went away to college, and I was in college for just a few months, and probably more information than anybody needs to know. But I was laying in bed with the latest girlfriend one morning, and pro wrestling came on TV. And it was WWWF. And I started to watch it and got hooked again and was really into it. I was successful at that point. I had my first big business run. I was in Santa Barbara, and I was promoting concerts. I owned, under my own banner, Bassman Productions. I had two nightclubs that I owned. I had a modeling agency, a band talent agency, kind of a little mini rock and roll empire of sorts. And I'm doing this and got totally jazzed on wrestling again and thought it might be fun to do something in the business. Of course, I had no idea what. And in watching it, I started to form a plan. I came to a conclusion. And the conclusion in the year 2019, looking back, is like, it's downright blasphemy. And I'll tell you why on my part. Because I was looking at guys like Dusty Rhodes and Wyndham and Rotundo, the American Express, and even Hulk Hogan. Because if you remember, Tom, of course, this is the era of the all-American hero versus the anti-American villain. Sure. And I remember, I'm looking at these guys. I'm also a huge comic book fan growing up. More DC than Marvel, but it's all the same. And I'm watching wrestling, and here's the blasphemy reference. I'm looking at these guys going, how are these guys the all-American heroes? They either don't look the part, they don't really have the body for it. Hogan did, but clearly by this video, he didn't have the hair for it. He didn't quite speak too articulately, you know, especially in Barry Windham's case, or, you know, body, Dusty Rhodes, again, they didn't, in my mind, espouse all-American values very sincerely. So, in other words, I was coming at this without realizing that these guys, and I owe all these guys, like, such a debt of gratitude now and so much respect, because they're all amazing at what they did. I just didn't understand it back then. I have no clue. So, having no clue, but being very entrepreneurial and just having the tendency to charge headlong into things without any research, I'm like, I'm going to go out and create a comic book group come to life and insert them into pro wrestling. And I'm going to call it Team America. And I'm going to find one black guy, one Italian American, one blonde haired, blue eyed, all American boy, and one American Indian that look great, that are handsome, that have great physiques, that could talk, that are sharp, that are athletic, and put them in red, white, and blue and launch them to the top of the business as Team America. Well, it was a faulty concept because, as I know now well, you can't take four brand new green guys and just stick them in the business, especially with the territory system. So nonetheless, I didn't do my research, so I went out to find four guys and I started recruiting. And at the long story, I'd say short, but this is not that short, sorry.
No, this is fascinating. This is great.
Okay, cool. So anyway, at the end of the day, I had my four guys. And here's a quick anecdote. If we put this team together now, you'd probably have a Hispanic American and you'd probably have an Asian American. But you want to guess why we didn't have that in 1985?
Or didn't I have no idea.
Because it's going to sound so weird, man, especially from a guy who's 5'4". They didn't grow those backgrounds over like 5'8", 5'9" back in those days, believe it or not. Huh. And, you know, I was looking for 6'2" and better, looking for giants that could, you know, go face-to-face with the Road Warriors back in the day. So I had my four guys. I spent a considerable amount of money doing some research and finding and hiring a trainer. That was Red Bastien. I rented a racquetball court. We put a ring in the racquetball court, got these four guys started. There were two other guys in our initial training class. One guy named Dave Sheldon, who went on to become the Angel of Death. He had some limited success in Bill Watts, UWF. and a guy named Steve DeSalvo, who had some success limited again in Canada. And I had my four guys. And as we got started, you know, I did great photography on them. I mean, probably the nicest promo kits anybody in wrestling at that time had. Again, no idea. It was just not a sellable concept with all this money and time and energy into it. And shortly after training began, I started to learn what some of the personalities were about and realized that in the blonde-haired, blood, all-American boy, a guy by the name of Jerry Botville, I had a complete maniac on my hands, so I dismissed him pretty quickly. And then in the American Indian, a guy named Ed Brock, and in my book, I talk about the five guys that had they stuck with it would have been the biggest stars. And Ed Brock had everything, man. He was the same size as Hogan, his better body, better looking, better athlete, much better version of Tom McGee. Problem with Ed Brock was, nicest guy in the world, just lazy as all get out. Just didn't have the drive or the ethic. So I regrettably had to get rid of him. Now I had this whole team and training, and I needed to kind of like, do you ever see the Brady Bunch?
Oh, sure.
Remember when Greg Brady was Johnny Bravo?
Yeah.
And then he finally realized that the reason he got hired is because he fit the suit, as a promoter explained it to him.
Yeah.
It wasn't because Greg Brady was particularly talented. Well, and not to take anything away from the guys that were part of the team and then became part of the team, but I went out to find replacements for my Indian and my All-American guy, and that turned out to be, respectively, the Ultimate Warrior and Sting.
Unbelievable.
So that's how that got started.
And you had no, I mean, you had no professional wrestling training, knew nothing about the business. You just kind of stumbled on it.
You know, I had no training whatsoever. Zero. Yeah, I stumbled on it. And, you know, I hustled so hard in those days that I always, you know, try to get in as hard and fast as possible, sometimes to my own detriment, because taking your time is not a bad thing. And when I put these promo kits together, I mailed them out to all the territories, because we used mail back in those days. There was no internet, certainly, or anything like this, Zoom or whatnot. So I got a call from Vern Gagne one day, which was like a really big deal for me. So I was a huge fan growing up, and I loved AWA and NWA and WWF, WWWF, and all the rest. And Vern flew all the way from Minneapolis to LA to meet with me. And I learned later why. He wanted to cherry pick my top two guys and break the team up, just because he wanted those guys for the AWA. So that was an eye-opener for me, and I started to learn a little bit about how things worked at that point.
So tell everyone, just to skip ahead a little bit in the story, give folks, especially some of our younger listeners, an idea of, you mentioned the Ultimate Warrior, you mentioned Sting. Who are some of the other guys that you have brought through your system and trained over the years, just to really set the stage for the magnitude of the work you've done in the business?
All right, you know, so yeah, ultimately years later in 98, I started an MMA and MMA gym, mixed martial arts, and I put a pro wrestling ring in, so I wanted to start a school. And I started a school, it was called Ultimate University, and started a promotion that was attendant to that called Ultimate Pro Wrestling, or UPW. And not long thereafter, signed my first development deal with WWF. They lost one of the W's at that point, now it's WWF. And I had two different contractual periods with them under UPW. And in that period of time, I discovered, trained, and delivered. Now, I say train. I did a little bit of it myself. I'm not a worker. I train promo class. I think I'm pretty good at that. Although you'll see an awful bit of me trying to show a guy named Sweet Billy D how to cut a promo in the Discovery Channel special that John Cena was first seen in. I did a little bit of psychology work in ring training, but I had great trainers. So when I say I never mean I. It's we, us, our. It was a whole collective effort. So let's say through the UPW system, which I ran point on, through the years, there were 43 guys and girls that went on to WWF and then WWE through me and my system. And, you know, that's a record that will probably never be equaled again. But as they say, that and, you know, $4 will get you a medium latte at Starbucks. But some of the guys and girls were Victoria, became WWE Women's Champion, of course. Nathan Jones, John Heidenreich, Chris Masters, The Miz, John Cena. So these are all people that started with me. There are also a whole bunch of others that came to us, guys like Paul London and Brian Kendrick. They were already well into their training and working days. but they would relocate, in their case, from Texas all the way to California to be part of my system because they believed they could best be seen through UPW than take the next leap. It wasn't like it is now where it's so easy to get invited to the Performance Center and so easy to be seen. Back in those days when Jim Ross and Bruce Pritchard were running talent relations, those guys were harder to get a hold of than the Pope, man. And you could have all, I mean, that's a bit of a pro wrestling-like exaggeration, obviously, but they were not easy to access. So I had people relocate literally from around the world. I counted at one time, people relocated from 15 different countries to come train with us. And forget probably most of the states to get their shot. And end of the day, 43 people. That's a pretty big number.
It's unbelievable. And we're going to, I think that's going to be a theme throughout some different matches that you and I are going to watch together. And I want to keep touching on that because it's unbelievable. So let's talk Warrior for a second here. How did you meet the Warrior and what was your initial impression of the guy when you first met him?
Well, I have two very separate and distinct first impressions. So first part 1A and 1B. 1A was after I had lost Ed Brock, and I got to tell him offline, send you a photo of Ed Brock. It'll blow you away. You look at him and go, man, I wish we had seen that guy do something. Because he truly puts Tom McGee to shame. I was casting about for the replacement for my Indian and my All-American guy. And a new friend at that time was Ed Connors, who was one of the founders and was the operating partner of Gold's Gym worldwide, including in Venice, where he was headquartered. And I told him we were looking, and he goes, you know, I think I might have the perfect guy for you. And he shows me this photo of, you know, Jim Hellwig in his bodybuilding prime. And I looked at that photo, I'm like, holy shit. Physique-wise, face-wise, I mean, this guy just, the hair, I mean, he looked absolutely amazing. So Ed said, can I set up a phone call? So anyway, pressure one was the visual, just the photographic image.
Sure.
Two was Ed asked if I wanted to set a call. And of course I took him up on it, got on the phone with Jim. And my initial impressions were extremely intelligent, extremely articulate, and pretty introspective. Businesslike for sure. But I thought for sure when I got off that first call that I had my guy. That's my first impression. You want to ask about more later, feel free.
Well, you know, as you went through the years, tell us about the relationship you had with him. Did you stay in touch? Did you not stay in touch? Good feelings, bad feelings? What was your relationship with him over time?
You know, it's funny. I'm I'm trying to think how to say this. This also is not very wrestling-like. I'm at a point in my life where I really try. I don't ever want to say or even think anything negative about anybody, but in the interest of a little bit of storytelling and perspective, things didn't go well. Jim moved out. He flew out from Atlanta and turned out he had two cars back in Atlanta, really nice cars that he wanted once he got there. So my guy, Garland Donahoe, who was a black member of the team and a friend to this day, I love Garland, got corralled by Jim into flying to Atlanta and driving the cars back. And Garland came back. I'll never forget. They got out of the car. I'd rented this house on this ratty little street in Reseda, California. We all lived in the house together. First mistake, or one of many mistakes. And I remember 2.5 days later, after they flew out, they pull up. So that's 2.5 days from Atlanta to L.A., right? That's pretty fast. And apparently Jim drove Garland like a slave master the entire way across the country. And Garland was not a guy to mess with. Of the four guys in the group, he was the real steel by far of the four. Garland came out of that car like almost crying. And he goes, Rick, he goes, dude, fasten your seatbelt. This guy is fucking nuts. And I'll never forget that. I'm like, okay. You know, I mean, I was pretty young at that time. I wasn't real experienced in the world, although I had pretty big dive in the rock and roll. So I'm like, well, I guess I knew enough to say or to think I'll see for myself. But Jim was pretty crazy, man. He had a hair trigger temper. He had a, my way is the only way opinion. And he rabble roused. He was definitely the smartest of the bunch, most intelligent, myself included. He was, I think, a pretty good at manipulation. And he essentially single-handedly broke the team up. He went to Red Bastien, our trainer, and said, Red, Steve and I want to leave. And Steve is Sting. And Sting wasn't in on this, and I know this now. He told me a long time ago, and I absolutely believe him. He said, Steve and I want to leave. We're the biggest and best looking guys in this group. Can you get us booked somewhere? And Red got them booked, and that was that. They were gone. Another anecdote for you. Myself and another guy named Richard Nomer, great guy. He was in the merchandise and licensing business. And back then he had the Madonna account and the Jackson 5 account, or the Jacksons, I should say. Richard and I financed this whole thing together. And we spent $56,000 at that time, which is a lot of money back then. The reason I remember this is we had the four guys, sign an agreement where they were jointly and severally liable for that amount should it ever come to pass. And my share was $28,000, Richard's was $28,000. About 20 years after the fact, or maybe around that period of time, I met up with Sting at Jerry's Deli in Studio City, and he handed me a check for $28,000. So I thought that'd be worth mentioning. So shout out to Sting. He's a good dude. He's a man of honor. He truly is. So anyway, we went our own ways. I was so intensely into that thing. I put so much time and energy and money into it that when they bailed, I tried to replace the guys again, and I did. We did more photo shoots. I finally realized I didn't want to do it and eventually quit. The only other interaction I had with Jim was many years later, ironically at Gold's Gym in Venice. I was there with some of my guys training, and he's in there. He's doing bicep curls. And I remember my thought process. I'm like, okay, this guy, in my opinion at least, absolutely burned me. But I was already at a point in my life where I just didn't like the idea of grudges and bad blood. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna try to be the bigger man here at 5'4", 135 pounds. And I walk up to Jim and I go, hey man, how are you doing? He's doing barbell curls, and he was already the champ at this point. He goes right into Ultimate Warrior mode while he's doing curls. He literally, Tom, like started to shake and vibrate right in front of me. And I could see him start to like turn red and purple, which was the miraculous thing you would see. It happened in the house all the time. He would change colors before your eyes. And he's that whole transformation. And trust me, I'm not high, but this is exactly how it happened. It was almost like an Incredible Hulk-like transformation, not to that degree, of course. And he starts shaking, and he looks at me, and he goes, you have the FBI following me. You have the police following me. He goes, and I'm like sitting there going, what is he talking about? He goes, I should take this barbell and jam it right up your ass. And I remember thinking, I'm pretty calm under like stress and conflicted situations, and I tend not to react too fast. So I thought I would try to be clever. And I said, well, I go, Jim, barbells and asses, man. I go, whatever you do in your private time is, you know, that's up to you. I go, but if you want to take your best shot, man, I go, take it. And I'm going to put money on me to leave you laying on the floor crying. And I don't think I'm that tough of a guy. I know my way around a fight to a degree. He's 150 pounds bigger. And, you know, even though he had no true fighting ability, he's in the ring throwing bodies around. So I probably would not have come out on the best side of that. But, I figured I really had nothing to lose. And after I said that to him, he continued shaking, took a couple steps back, threw the barbell on the ground, and turned around and stormed out of the gym. And that was my last interaction with him. That was it.
You know,
you can't make this stuff up, right?
No, and you hear some of these stories, and I mean, not to pick on them, especially because they're deceased, but you hear some of these stories about both him and Randy Savage, and you think, look, what you saw on screen was maybe turned up a little bit, but that was who they were. And to a certain degree, I think that's why the characters worked. I mean, they were so ridiculous and larger than life. You don't see people like that normally. I mean, that's just a crazy interaction that sticks in your mind, you know, whatever we are, 30 years later.
Absolutely. And I will say this about him. He absolutely understood what he had with that character, and he developed that character. So that's his. He mastered it. And I remember reading something. It was really, 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 honestly, like even a week ago about him. Oh, you know what it was? It was about Bret Hart. I guess he and Bret Hart had heat. And
shocking.
Yeah. Right. I think it was Bret, who I think is a cool guy, but that's my thing. He was saying, Warrior goes, I took a lot of flack for not knowing how to quote unquote wrestle. And he's like, it doesn't fucking matter. I mean, what he said, I have to tell you, I mean, I'm a student of the game now. And I like to say, you know, I'm nowhere near the student or the expert that my good pal Jim Cornette is. And I mean that sincerely. He knows 100 times. He'll forget more than I'll ever know. But I know enough to understand it now. And that's, and I really appreciate what goes into making a good match, a good program, a good worker. And that said, at the same time, I have to agree with what Warrior said. He knew what he had. He knew how to work it. And he was extremely successful. So how do you argue that?
You're exactly right. And we're still talking about him, and people are still dressing up as Halloween with him. And I mean, the character, it'll live on forever, and it's phenomenal. So yeah, you know what? Maybe he didn't have the best in-ring psychology. Maybe he didn't go through the territories like others, whatever. You know, I mean, even this match, I mean, it's all smoke and mirrors. Did you ever hear anything about how they laid this out? Because famously, like, they went to a ring, they planned out every move. I mean, both of them worked probably harder at planning this match than any other match in their careers.
Well, I've heard what everybody else has, you know, what you read in Dave's sheets and everybody else's sheets. I did have the opportunity to talk with Pat Patterson about it years ago, you know, in years between the match and now. And he explained it to me the same way we've all heard it, that they spotted the whole thing out, obviously. They both contributed ideas. I think the match is more Pat's than anybody else's, but Hulk's to a large degree. But, man, you know, I have to say this. No matter whose match it was, when, you know, I'm looking at – this is my first Zoom call, by the way. I love technology.
This is great, right?
It fascinates me that this stuff actually works like this. And when this match came up on the screen, I saw – you said, okay, I cut the entrances out, but it's still 25 minutes, right?
Correct, yeah. We're at 24 minutes right now.
All right, 24 minutes. And you know, it astounds me that Warrior, even Hogan for that matter, got through a 24 minutes, and it was great. So smoke and mirrors, spotted out, whatever you call it, whatever I call it. It was really entertaining, man. And I remember buying the pay-per-view to watch it and thinking that at the time.
Were you proud of him?
You know, I can't, no. I would be like really disingenuous if I said
no,
that.
No, it's okay if you weren't. I'm what were you thinking in 1990 as you watched this?
I have to think about this. I'm not holding back an answer. I want to give you a genuine answer. I should probably move the screen sometime during the call and show you some of like my frame photos and stuff back here down in my office. I had one thing that I framed because if you remember, Sting and Warrior both won their first world championships about maybe 2 months apart from each other at the most.
So and it was, this was April 1st of 90, and then Sting's was on July 7th of 90, which in my research, you know, I didn't realize it was just a few months apart like that. That's incredible.
Yeah. 3 months. Okay. And what I remember is they both had like really beautiful pro wrestling illustrated covers with them and the belts. So I framed this big thing where I took the two magazine covers and a photo of us together and put it all in the same frame. So maybe there was some pride there. But, you know, at the end of the day, man, I have to admit, I really didn't have much to do with their success. I got them both into the business. Warrior may have found his way otherwise. I don't know. Sting definitely would not have. I talked him into doing it. Sting wanted no part of being in the business, strangely enough. Look what happened with him. But I didn't do much. You know, I got him started. I got him a trainer who got them a hookup to get into a territory. So I really can't take all that much credit other than, you know, the initial impetus. So I don't know what there is to be proud of. But nonetheless, it's pretty cool. And admittedly, man, it's gotten me a lot of mileage out of the year, too. It opened doors for me.
Well, and you know, to the point earlier, when we were talking about whatever, some lack of, you know, high flying, incredible 5-star match or, you know, whatever, as we watch these matches, obviously we're watching them on mute. So I've been paying more attention to crowd reaction than I ever probably did prior to this. And it's, I look at the fans, I mean, they went nuts. They loved it. You know, it was significant to them. Therefore, you can't really say that it wasn't a home run of a match. And obviously it's something that lives on all these years later. At the end of the match, when Hogan, he kind of kicks out at like 2 3/4, and then, you know, afterwards he hands Warrior the belt and stays in the ring. I mean, do you think that it took away a little bit from the win? Like, it wasn't completely decisive?
You know what? I have to admit, I've seen this match so many times, and I've never noticed an early kick out. But that aside, for the moment, the aftermath. Let's go back to it. I do want to.
Yeah, look at this. We've never done this. This is the first time in the history of the payoff that we have gone back and rewound to show our guest.
Oh, right.
So
on.
There you go. Okay, here we go. Splash.
Yeah, a little early.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I would say that. You know, if that hadn't happened, the whole deal at the end with Hulk handing the belt and doing what he did, then that's just Hulk being Hulk, man. You know.
I know. I know.
With Eric Bischoff and Jason Hervey, I co-executive produced that one series, the reality show that he had, not Hogan Knows Best, but Hulk Hogan's Celebrity Championship Wrestling. Are you familiar with that?
Never heard of it.
One season on the CW, Hulk Hogan's Celebrity Championship Wrestling, which is, if you can imagine applying the Dancing with the Stars format to pro wrestling, that's what this show was.
And how did I miss this?
Oh, dude, it's so bad. Oh, my God. The trainers, unfortunately, on the show were Brian Knobbs and Brutus. They didn't do anything. My guys did the training. Tom Howard ran it, and my instructors did it. And Brutus and Knobbs were the on-screen guys, although we were all on screen. And the celebrities were people like Dennis Rodman, Butterbean, you know, Danny Bonaducci, Todd Bridges, stuff like that. It was pretty bad. But I got to know Hulk really well during that point. And I liked the guy, but he's always in the mode, you know?
Yeah.
He's always in the mode. He's excellent at putting himself over, put it that way. But he's made, you know, it's probably sound like a bit of a wrestling mark. He's probably one of the most famous celebrities or most iconic celebrities from this country.
You know, the first reaction's like, oh, God, that's crazy. He's a pro wrestler. And then you sit back and you think, and man, you know, you go to a 4th of July cookout and say, who knows Hulk Hogan? Every hand's going up, right?
Without
like,
question.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievable. All right, so let's tie a bow on this episode. Last thing I want to ask you was, you know, you find out the untimely passing of the Warrior. What's your initial reaction?
My initial reaction, and it's a conversation I had with myself for years and with some people that are close to me in the business, guys like Mike Bucci, Nova, were that I would have loved to have had a chance to sit down with him and have a just real mellow heart-to-heart, not about who did what or about casting any blame, but just saying, hey, and seeing if we both could come to a place where we felt cool about everything.
Yeah,
I had a little bit of regret that didn't happen when he passed. And then, of course, I felt badly for his daughters because they look like beautiful, well-adjusted kids, and I hope they are. I hope they're doing well. You know?
Yeah, well, it's tough. He actually passed away literally, you know, right down the street from where I live. It's walking distance, and I drive by it, you know, at least once a week. It's a shame, you know, and it's tough in life when we don't like to lose people without closure. And I think that you probably would have come to, you know, an understanding and maybe even a few laughs about what happened, because as time passes, we realize that some of these things that we thought were so important and serious just aren't in the grand scheme of things, but that's a shame. Really appreciate you opening up and sharing a little bit about the Warriors. We watched this match and provided some great commentary. So really enjoyed it, and it was great having you here on The Payoff.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, man.
Welcome back, Tom. I will let you share your thoughts on The Payoff.
All right, so a couple quick things, and I'll probably elaborate on some of this when I give my payoff score here in a few minutes, but obviously it's an awesome match. You know, you had these major crowd pops, big-time finish, iconic images. The Warrior with the two belts and the fireworks, it's probably one of my favorite moments ever. I just loved it. So overall, this match had everything we love about pro wrestling. Thought our guest, Rick Baskin, was fantastic. Really good information. You know, the stumbling on pro wrestling by creating a stable, mailing out the press kits to all the territories, sending 43 different superstars to the WWF over time, and some of them came through a system, some of them started a system. It was like NXT before NXT, years before in many ways. Any talent come from 15 different countries. So I know Rick and I didn't talk about the match a ton, but I thought he had some really interesting information. And every week, Jeff, our guests are going to be different, right? Some of them are going to get really detailed on the psychology of the match and what happened and some things that maybe you didn't realize when you were watching the match. Other guys like Rick are coming from a totally different perspective. So that's what one of the things I love about this show is that we're always going to get different perspectives, different people, and coming at it from different angles. I think that's what makes it fun. So, you know, I also think it's interesting. You know, these two obviously laid out the match. And I know it's like a badge of honor for wrestlers to quote unquote call it in the ring, but these two wrestlers needed to plan the match ahead of time. And Hogan and Andre planned the match ahead of time. Steamboat and Savage planned ahead of time. So I thought them laying out the match and probably doing as much as they could with their limitations, just based on size and in-ring ability, I thought they did a really good job. Also, it was fun to hear about Hulk Hogan's Celebrity Championship Wrestling, which was on the Country Music Channel. Had no idea that was a thing. So I went ahead, Jeff, and looked it up on YouTube. And if you're having trouble falling asleep tonight, go watch a couple episodes of that. Good reality cast. We had Rodman, Butterbean, to name a few. So that was fun to learn about that. And Warriors ring gear, I always loved it. This was like my favorite one ever. And I don't know if it's because it was such an iconic moment, but I love that gear and the paint and the colors and just awesome. Last thing I had, Jeff, I'm going to make a bold statement here. Of all the nonsense, fake stuff that happens regularly in pro wrestling, I think the test of strength might be the most ridiculous of them all. What do you think?
It's up there. It's definitely high up there. I'd have to think about, you got me on the spot, but I think that's an out there one.
Okay. So I don't know what it's accomplishing or what the purpose is. Now, another question for you. Do you know about this famous GIF online regarding that test of strength?
Know about it and used it too many times.
So, okay. Yeah. I found out like a few weeks ago this was a thing. I had no idea. So if you don't know what we're talking about, just go check it out. All right. Those are my thoughts on the payoff. Jeff, what do you have for us?
Yeah, I want to start with, I miss Howard Finkel as an in-ring announcer. I know the internet loves to just really come down on commentary nowadays, but with the ring announcers, I think Greg Hamilton, who calls SmackDown, is fantastic, and you know he's doing a good job, but Howard Finkel is timeless. It's just a little thing, but you know me, kind of, you know, the nostalgia and going back, it was cool though, and I enjoy hearing his voice whenever I can. Even before this one started, the crowd was crazy. I like the line. It was actually from Jesse Ventura. He said, "I'm not even going to try and talk over this gorilla." It was so refreshing to just let a moment happen. I ended up watched it and it was like, wow, that's nice. And then I actually went back and timed it. It was 1 minute and 12 seconds of just letting Hogan enter and nothing else. And so I feel like that would never happen today, but it was just really cool to have that and just enjoy that little moment. And I thought that was great. So I think that by technical wrestling standards, this match was, I'll say, subpar. I was ready to rest myself. There was just so many rest holds. You know, with that said, you know, on the flip side to that, it's hard to imagine maybe even like five matches where the spectacle was higher than these guys. And so, put the wrestling aside, the spectacle was just, you know, above average in every way. And so, you know, every punch, kick, just random slam, the crowd loved it. They couldn't get enough of it between these two guys. And so, I did find it comical. I wish that we could find a wrestler nowadays that used the big splash as their finisher. I knew how the match ended. You know, I've seen this one a lot of times over the years. And so, I just think that the big splash is a underutilized finisher that needs to be brought back by someone. It's also probably why, and we're going to talk about it, by why it 3.01 seconds, Hulk kicked out. I get part of that was for the story, but the splash can only do so well. So, you know, and say what you will about the booking. They had their little moment. It was nice for Hulk to pass the torch a little bit and give Warrior the belt. Commentary was I say, tripping over itself to make sure that Hogan went over even in defeat. And they knew it was going to happen, so that was planned out. I wish they had said a little more about Warrior, but boy, they could, even with him losing, they could not get enough of Hulk. So, Tom, thoughts?
Dude, you're being generous with that kick out. That thing was like 2.75, not 3.01. God, you know, it just frustrates me. You know, I don't know why it happened. I don't know the thinking behind it. I've heard different stories over the years. It just made Warrior look weak. It was like, yeah, he kind of beat him. He's kind of champion. But yeah, it wasn't a definitive pin. You know, it wasn't a sound victory. So that always frustrated me. Now, part of me says, you know, Hogan just should not have been involved after the match. You know, I know they were trying to do the pass the torch, and I love Gorilla's commentary of the Hulkster has just taken one giant step towards immortality. I love that, but I just felt that Hogan's involvement between the kickout and after the match, the kickout should have never happened. He should have really beat him. I understand the passing the torch, but it should have just happened quicker. But otherwise, it was awesome, obviously. So, Jeff, we covered the payoff. Walk everyone through the aftermath.
So, newly crowned champion, the Ultimate Warrior, he was a pretty good draw for the company. He ended up rekindling a feud with Ravishing Rick Rude. The two had interactions that actually dated back to the previous Royal Rumble of 1989. So, really almost a year before any of this story with the Hulk happened. Warrior would beat Rude in a steel cage match at SummerSlam 1990 to retain. He eventually ended up losing the title to Sergeant Slaughter at the next Royal Rumble in 1991. And so hearing a lot of the same names, like we said, just because there were only these pay-per-views that were happening on. That's why you always hear the big four. These were the big four. So he didn't have a ton of pay-per-view defenses because of that. A lot of it was on TV. And so one where he was on pay-per-view but didn't defend it was the Survivor Series 1990. It was a 3-on-5 Survivor Series match because some of the superstars had been eliminated in previous matches throughout that pay-per-view. And so it was Ultimate Warrior, Hulk Hogan, and Tito Santana. And they ended up defeating, and this is a, boy, this is a team. You have Hercules, Paul Roma, Rick Martel, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and the Warlord. And of course, at ringside, we cannot leave out Virgil and Slick.
What a shitty main event.
Boy, that is a $59.99 pay-per-view, man. That is impressive. So, you know, so Tom, we like giving a little extra trivia time. What character made their debut at Survivor Series 1990?
I don't remember.
So this would be the, I say debut, it was more the hatching of the one and only Gobbledygooker. And so,
why didn't he get a title run?
Boy, that, I can't, oh, talk about some fantasy booking, buddy. Like, that is one.
I'm surprised I didn't remember that, but I'm actually glad I didn't. So
30 years later,
let's hope I forget that happened again at some point.
So if you remember, the Warrior had the Intercontinental belt. And so he actually relinquished that because he did beat Hulk. And so unlike Becky Two Belts, you could not hold two belts back then. And so there was a tournament to find a new champ. And that was won by the one and only Mr. Perfect. Of course it was.
And do you know the story about why he won that?
Why?
Because he's perfect.
I'm waiting for the crickets. Okay, so we're just going to power through here, everybody. So Hogan took off some time and rekindled his feud with Earthquake. You can't forget about Earthquake, who, of course, we have now come full circle, who played a hand in getting Hulk and Warrior to come together. So there was, after the Mania match, there was a little bit of tease for retirement of Hogan. And fans were actually, I love reading this. I can't even imagine this nowadays. They were encouraged to write in and mail in to Hulk to get him to stay and to show your support. And so I guess that would be Twitter nowadays.
It worked. He stayed.
He stayed. Yeah, who knows if it was the letters. If anybody sent one of those letters and has a copy by chance, please tweet that to us. That would be fantastic.
That would be great. Yeah, I mean, look, your support kept him in the business another, what,
You never know.
17 years more working. So
here, and we still have him. Yep. So you know, these two, Hogan and Earthquake, they actually had a lot of back and forth. I didn't know just how much they had, but they feuded for almost a year until Hogan eventually turned his attention to winning the championship back from Sergeant Slaughter, which he did. So, Tom, a lot of little things playing out here, but it was all pretty cool, you know, and hearing some of these names just talking about them, they were the biggest names. And so anything I missed out on the aftermath?
No, I mean, the fact is that really not much of note happened with Warrior and Hogan specifically against each other following this. You know, look, I look at Savage and Hogan at WrestleMania 5. I look at this match at WrestleMania 6. And I think at both situations, I wanted to see the rematch. You know, I think there was so much more mileage and the feuds each year were so good. I don't understand why they just kind of moved on. And I know you want to provide new matches, new programs, different main events. But I look back and wonder, you know, if just a straight up rematch at some point would have been better. I mean, you can't tell me that Survivor Series wouldn't have been better than that god-awful main event you just told us about if they would have done Warrior Hogan straight up or Warrior Hogan in a steel cage or even like Team Warrior, Team Hogan. It comes down to those two in the final two and maybe Hogan gets his win back and you finish it off at Royal Rumble or WrestleMania. I don't know. It's just, I know the Survivor Series is like a unique concept at that time, but I just wonder what could have been with some different booking each of those times. Interestingly enough, and this was only a few weeks ago, I don't know if you caught this, Jeff, but Hogan was on Austin's podcast and he says, and again, I don't take this with a grain of salt, but what he says is at the time, he really wanted to turn heel. And what he had pitched to Vince was, I'm going to come back down the aisleway. I'm going to attack the Warrior and I'm going to call myself Triple H, which stands for Hollywood Hulk Hogan. Again, I don't know if it's true or not, but Hogan just said it. If that would have happened to me, it's even bigger, more shocking, and I think better than what happened at Bash of the Beach. And I know that's saying a lot, but dude, that era, Hogan turning heel, like, could you imagine? It might have been the most shocking thing to ever happen. And not that the Bash at the Beach wasn't, but man, at that era, I just can't imagine how those fans would have reacted. You know, that being said, I really enjoyed the Hogan Slaughter WrestleMania 7 main event. We also got that Warrior Savage, you know, kind of semi-main event retirement match on that show. So it wasn't like we were deprived of anything, but again, I think that would have been fun. Hogan Warrior did win Match of the Year through Pro Wrestling Illustrated in 1990 as voted on by the readers. So thought that was interesting. And, you know, it was just a great match, an iconic match. And again, maybe not the best in-ring technical match by any, you know, standards like you said, but obviously fans dug it. The crowd dug it. So it was pretty cool. But Jeff, tell us how it was reviewed elsewhere.
Yeah, I want to start, and we always try and give a, you know, some different perspective and insight. And so I want to start with Grapple. It's an app that's out there that we use and check occasionally. And so it's a fan aggregate score, and anybody can kind of submit what they think. And so they have this match at a 3.75 from 57 ratings. You know, not bad. For comparison, the Warrior Savage at the next Mania, Mania 7, it's a 4.31 on 60 ratings. So, Tom, I know you'll be as disappointed as me. There was no rating for the Hogan Warrior rematch at Halloween Havoc 1998.
Sure there was. So, it was zero.
Well, hey, but it's not listed, so who knows? So I'm going to submit it with a 5. But anyways, I wouldn't do that. But I will say Meltzer gave it a 3.75, so he was right on line with the aggregate score. And Wade Keller wrote, and I'll just read it verbatim here because it's enjoyable. A big splash and Hogan kicks out to a huge pop. Hogan is on his knees and he no-sells the punches and shakes his head and does the usual stuff. Hogan blocks punches and returns fire. Big boot, but the leg drop misses and Warrior hits another big splash for 3. As Hogan is just about to kick out, no boos, but I think a good portion of the crowd is pretty shocked here. Hogan grabs his belt outside the ring and walks up the steps and back in. Hogan presents Warrior with the title, then raises his hand and hugs him. Warrior holds up both the WWE and Intercontinental titles in the corner as a dejected Hogan gets into a mini ring for the ride of shame. End quote. I will say we definitely need to bring back the mini ring, which is just a great little piece. But also, Tom, what do you think about these different takes?
Yeah, I mean, could you imagine, like, in today's day and age, these guys coming down to with, like, that stupid little ring? It'd be pretty good.
That'd be funny.
Yeah. Well, didn't they bring, I think they brought some guys down for, like, a big battle royal or something in, like, the back of carts or something.
It was the Rumble.
That's right. We need the actual ring back. So here's my take. What you just said above, I think the 3.7 out of 5, which you had indicated both was in Grapple and Meltzer's write-up of the match, I think that's light. I think it's really light. And I say that because it's just too big of a moment, too iconic. The crowd was eating it up too much for it not to be higher. I mean, even at a 4, but I just think 3.7, 3.75, way, way, way too light. Keller saying mini ring for the ride of shame is a great line. And he's also right in saying the crowd was absolutely shocked at the kickout. They were. That's, I mean, not to bang on the current product even more than we already do, but, you know, when you kick out of everything, then it doesn't matter as much. And that kickout was just, it was shocking and it was awesome. So yeah, we really hadn't seen anyone kick out like that. I mean, it was just so rare. So Jeff, more importantly than any of that, our payoff score. So walk everyone through what the payoff score is and what you had for this week's payoff score.
Yeah, you know, we try and give just every week a score. We don't rank the match just purely on airing quality, but we look at everything to determine a 1 through 10. So it's the build, the crowd, the commentary, how it falls into other things and storylines going on at the time, and really just whatever we feel is important to the overall just drama and just presentation of the match and the show. So it's not just the maneuvers that two guys are doing in the ring. So there really is no specific formula that him and I are using. We're just two guys that come up with a score. And so as a reminder, we don't discuss these in advance. So we usually go in blind. And so we never know what we're going to say. But I will say that I'm going to go with an 8.5, that the quote, wrestling was serviceable at best. You know, we can't overlook though what this match means, like in its place in the greater wrestling universe, because it really just sent ripples across all of that. And not just wrestling, but like society too. Like at the time, wrestling nowadays or social media and all this other stuff, and it's very ingrained, but this was a big deal because there was still that kind of veil of, you know, what wrestling was, and not everybody knew what was happening. And so to see these guys and have this interaction and then just think like, whoa, like Warrior beat Hogan, that was a big deal. And so I'm going to stick with an 8.5 just because overall, you know, it's got such a great place and just so instrumental in so many other things. Tom?
You're not kidding. I mean, as Vince McMahon said, these are the two most powerful forces in the universe colliding. It's far bigger than pro wrestling. But hey, I got to tell you, I went back and forth on this one. All right. I was everywhere between an 8 and 9. I locked this one in at a 9. I love how hot the crowd was. I know it wasn't the best wrestling match ever, but they loved it. I loved it. You had no idea who was going to win. You had some big, meaningful kickouts. I think the finishing sequence was really, really good outside of the poorly timed kickoff or kickout. It's just hard to imagine Hogan losing, you know, especially clean. And it's kind of the first major time it ever happened where someone just got the better of him straight up one-on-one. So the build, it wasn't great. It was actually pretty basic if you go back and watch some of the highlights before the match started. But then at the same time, that iconic moment where they went face-to-face at the Rumble was just incredible. And back in those days, they really did do a good job of keeping people separate, right? It was a lot easier to create moments like that because they were kept separate. So the only recent example I can really think of like that was when the Wyatts and the Shield, they had a 3-on-3 match. They went face-to-face at a pay-per-view. The crowd started chanting, "Holy shit," before the match started. And really, it just shows that, you know, moments like that are awesome, where you have these major unique characters go face to face. They haven't interacted or been around each other much. And it's just this great TV, and it's really simple, but it's rare we see it anymore. The only thing that keeps this from being any higher for me is really the finish and the aftermath. I mean, I think the build maybe could have been a little better. It was pretty basic. That finish, man, I hated that quick kick out by Hogan. I don't think it served any purpose. If you want to justify it and say, oh, well, that would lead to a rematch. Like, you're telling me people wouldn't have believed Hulk Hogan was still a force to be reckoned with if he didn't kick out at 2.75? Like, I don't buy that at all. And again, I just think that Hogan was a little too involved in the post-match to where it wasn't all Warriors moment. So it was kind of like, hey, this guy's going to get the torch for now, but keep it warm for me, brother. And if you're going to involve Hogan so much, I think they just should have turned him heel and set up a full-year program and ran with it. So I love that imagery of the belts. I love the firework. Just so much about this I loved, and just a few little tweaks. And again, it's easy for us all these years later to critique things. But overall, it's awesome. It's iconic. I'm giving it a 9.
Yeah, you know, and I just enjoyed talking about this match. It's a classic. And, you know, we can't thank Rick Bassman enough for joining us and kind of sharing his insight. It's always cool, like I said, to just hear a different perspective. And that's what we're hearing just from all of you as our, you know, our loyal listeners, that you guys just want to hear all of this. You're enjoying all pieces of this, and so I keep bringing to you. So the final rundown, you know, subscribe. 5 stars. Spread the word about the payoff. It's the only way we can continue to be successful and continue to bring you this great content. And so along with that, if you really love what we're doing, we made it simple. And if you want to support our Patreon, it's just payoffpatreon.com. Super simple, one tier, $10. We're bringing you all of the content. And so, of course, Tom and I, we're always Twitter, Instagram. We're always checking that stuff, Facebook, at Payoff Pod. You can always find us on there, and we try and respond as quickly as possible. And we love hearing from our fans. And then, you know, lastly, Tom, it's been a good week. I know you love saying it, so I'm going to let you do it this week.
The part where I say thank you for joining us on The Payoff?
You got it, brother.
Hell yeah. Thank you for joining us on The Payoff.